This week on Behind the Lens, the battle over short-term rentals. The New Orleans City Council voted to end whole home rentals in residentially zoned areas, but the debate isn't over yet. Michael Isaac Stein will join me. Also, asbestos in local schools. Remediation work at two New Orleans charter schools is taking longer than expected, forcing students to spend a second year at temporary facilities. Education reporter Marta Jusen has the details. And flooding. New Orleanians woke up on Mother's Day to find that their property, cars, homes, and businesses had taken on water during severe overnight storms. I sat down with Brian Knighton, owner of the Broad Theater, to talk about how floodwaters have impacted his business. I'm Jessica Rosegard. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
New Orleans City Council has been working on restricting rules surrounding short-term rentals in the city. The council voted on some new reforms this week. Michael Isaac Stein is here to explain. Michael, let's start by reviewing the current regulations on short-term rentals in New Orleans, which went into effect under the Landrieu administration and were written with input from Airbnb.
So there was definitely a lot of criticism back when these were passed. They were originally passed in 2016, went into effect in April 2017. And I think the biggest criticism was on one type of permit called the temporary residential permit. And those were created to be, you know, if you're going out of town for Jazz Fest or Mardi Gras, you know, just a couple weeks a year, you can rent out your home. But the amount of days that temporary permit allowed you to rent out your home was increased to 90 days. And that basically covers every weekend day of the year. So temporary permits quickly became the most popular type of license in the city, with certain companies and certain developers buying up dozens of homes, getting temporary permits for them and renting them out, you know, on all the weekends. And basically they were empty the rest of the time. So that's where a lot of the criticism of that last plan came from.
Because neighbors complained, you know, that's their whole problem with Airbnb is that you have these empty properties, not to mention turnover. So that regulation didn't really change that problem for a lot of neighborhoods. What were the other two regulations that went into effect at that time? How did those work?
So there were two other types of permits. One was an accessory permit, which basically required you to have a homestead exemption, required you to be on site during a guest stay. And this is basically, you know, now that the council is looking to reform it, these accessory permits are basically what they're modeling the new permits off of. And then the last was a commercial permit. And we'll get into this later, but commercial permits, how those are going to change is still very much up in the air.
So a new city council was elected since those regulations went into effect. Tighter regulations on short-term rentals was an issue many candidates ran on. So 1 year after they were sworn in, what have they delivered?
Well, almost immediately after this new council formed, they placed a moratorium on those temporary residential permits that we talked about. And that moratorium is still in place. And so basically, everyone who had a temporary permit could keep it, but by now, all of those have expired. So they've more or less already gotten rid of that permit. So that was a pretty major change. And then they ordered the City Planning Commission to study, you know, what the new regulations should look like. And basically, it seems like they're not moving on this, but it's really just this very long bureaucratic process. I mean, there's been vote after vote after study. And, you know, we really are getting to the end here. I think to some people it may look like inaction, but it just has been that this process takes a long time. So I would say that with the moratorium and the study, they really did, you know, take immediate action on it. And now we're kind of seeing that all come together.
Based on what the council approved in Thursday's meeting, what would change?
A couple of the biggest changes. Well, first of all, there's currently a full ban in the French Quarter. They also approved a full ban in the Garden District. Garden District residents had complained for a while. There was some pushback here. I think some people saw it as, you know, sure, Garden District residents don't want short-term rentals, neither do residents of the 7th Ward or of the, you know. So the question was, why does the Garden District get to choose its own fate while other neighborhoods don't? But that was, you know, a change that they approved yesterday. The other major change is to how whole home residential rentals will work. It eliminates the ability of someone to rent out an entire property in a residential neighborhood. In order to have a residential permit under the potential new rules, you need to have a homestead exemption for that property, and it would have to be your primary residence. And you would never be able to rent out a full property. So what that means is if you have a property that has one single like unit or dwelling, you would not be able to rent out the whole thing. You could only rent out rooms in it. But let's say you had a double shotgun, you would be able to rent out one whole side while you lived in the other. And you can rent out on any one property, you can rent out up to three units, meaning that if you had a fourplex, you could live in one and rent out the other three. The City Planning Commission had originally recommended limiting that to one unit per property. The City Council increased that to three. So I think that's one of the biggest changes.
For example, my place, I'm the only person who lives there. And if I'm going out of town for 2 weeks, I can't rent my entire place as a short-term rental when I am out of town for 2 weeks.
So that's actually an interesting question. So when the City Council first proposed these rules from recommendations from the City Planning Commission, they had said that the owner of the property would have to be on site during a guest stay. They passed an amendment that somewhat loosened that requirement. And they did that, I think the justification was fair. I think they, one example that was given is, let's say you're in the military and you're called up for active duty someplace else, should you have to lose out on that money? So they allowed for instances for when someone reasonably could not be on site. What's yet to be seen is how that's going to be enforced, whether that is going to be applied really to reasonable situations where people can't be there, or whether that might be abused or stretched a little bit. So that's we're going to have to see how that plays out.
And you've mentioned that the council was working off of recommendations from the City Planning Commission. There are other recommendations, though, that haven't been addressed yet, and they're a bit complicated.
Yeah, so some of the most contentious details in the short-term rental plan are still kind of up for debate. I think one of the biggest ones that you heard over and over during Thursday's public comment period was that enforcement is going to be key, that these new regulations won't really mean anything unless they're actually enforced. And where that comes from, we were just talking about this amendment yesterday that loosened requirements to stay on site. And like we talked about, there are very legitimate reasons why someone who, really does want to follow the rules might not be able to be there. But at the same time, I think what, short-term rental critics have said all along is that the rules need to be ironclad because, like, the developers and the different businesses that are setting up these kind of mass operations of short-term rentals, they're pretty good at skirting the rules or using the rules to their advantage in ways that they weren't designed to. So that's kind of been a constant theme. So how enforcement is going to work and how it's going to be improved from the current situation is still up in the air. Another big question mark is on commercial permits. So there's been a lot of discussion, for example, of putting a 25% cap on any commercially zoned building in places like the CBD. That still needs to be, fleshed out. There has not been a decision on that. Another big issue is that the council has talked about trying to leverage short-term rentals in commercial areas as a way to create more affordable housing. So you might have heard the term one-for-one match before. It's something that Councilwoman Kristen Palmer has advocated for. But basically, if a commercial building has a short-term rental, they need to add one affordable housing. So for each unit, one-to-one match. And then the final thing that's still up in the air, the council had long talked about increasing fees on short-term rentals in order to raise money for the Neighborhood Housing Improvement Fund, which, helps fund affordable housing projects. Mayor Cantrell's administration kind of threw a wrench in that plan with her pretty notorious at this point infrastructure plan that she's working on at the legislature. So that plan is comprised of a bunch of legislation, one of which would raise taxes on short-term rentals in New Orleans that would go directly to an infrastructure fund. Now that complicates things for the council because you can only tax things to a certain point, right, before it becomes overly burdensome. So I think now they're reticent to add more fees if this tax is also going to be lopped on top of that. At the same time, though, the council will have final say over this tax, so up to 6.75%. So it's possible they could set this tax lower or at 0% and do their fees instead. So that's another, big question mark.
And what kind of timeline are we looking at for having this issue sort of settled in the council?
So they're going to take a final vote on the ordinance in the next 90 days. So, you know, in the next 3 months, we'll really see all these things kind of dealt with. We don't know, you know, there's been talks of a separate meeting to deal with the commercial aspects of these things, or they might just show up to the final vote on this ordinance and figure it out there. So, you know, we'll just have to keep an eye out. But in the next 90 days, we'll see the resolution of this year-long process.
Michael Isaac Stein, thank you.
Thank you.
Two New Orleans charter schools will spend a second school year in temporary facilities as multi-million-dollar asbestos remediation jobs have fallen behind schedule. Marta Jusen has been following this story for The Lens. Marta, an asbestos removal project at Lafayette Academy made news in 2018 when it was discovered that students may have been exposed to dangerous particulates. What happened that made that become public?
Choice Foundation learned that they couldn't occupy the school in the upcoming school year because there had been an asbestos exposure caused by some contractors. Obviously, that created a whole lot of panic for parents who are worried about their kids. Actually, Jess Clark at WWNO reported that they had been working on asbestos tiles in the building while children had been there. And so obviously that was of great concern, and things just kind of kept unraveling from there. Then the parents learned that they wouldn't be able to be in the building for the next upcoming school year.
Right. So this construction crew was in there and in the process of removing asbestos, disrupted some asbestos and possibly contaminated the area. So the school that the students were being moved to while the asbestos situation was cleaned up at Lafayette Academy also had asbestos problems.
Right. So that was kind of a double whammy for parents. Then they were worried about the relocation. Students were supposed to move into McDonough 35, and the district was preparing what was a high school for the elementary students. And that's when the contractor there also ran into an asbestos issue. Luckily, they were able to clean that one up, and students were able to start school last fall.
The Orleans Parish School Board filed a lawsuit last Friday related to this issue. What are the details there?
So the school board and Choice Foundation, the charter group that runs Lafayette Academy, both filed a lawsuit against Jacobs and CSRS, which were the contractors on that project. The district is seeking, I believe, around $5 million. They say that's been their damages from having to relocate schools over the years. And it's kind of a ripple effect because the project is taking so long that they're now having to have schools relocated for a second year. Choice Foundation is saying they've spent $1.3 million replacing asbestos, potentially asbestos-contaminated property.
And that would include what at the school?
It's like computers, books, chairs, tables, anything from furniture to supplies to, I think they said their computer servers were in the building.
So not just in the air, but particulates that could have fallen on structures that kids would touch.
Right. So when they left the school, I mean, they have not been back in that building, to my knowledge.
The asbestos removal and remediation at Lafayette Academy was supposed to be finished for the 2019-2020 school year. As you said, that project is behind schedule. So how has that impacted the school in terms of even something like enrollment?
We don't know for sure yet, but Lafayette Academy is certainly concerned about it. They say they're not going to know until they talk to more parents and make a more firm calculation. But they are also worried and seeking financial losses for those students that they've potentially lost and their MFP state per pupil funding that they've been losing every year.
Meanwhile, over on the West Bank, the Rosenwald Collegiate Academy building is undergoing a $1.3 million asbestos cleanup of its own. How was that discovered?
This is a bit of an interesting scenario. So when the Recovery School District came in 10 years ago, 12 years ago, they took control of buildings that the Orleans Parish School District still owned. So then we have kind of this dual ownership model where RSD is controlling contractors, OPSB owns the building, OPSB doesn't necessarily know what's going on at all of its buildings. And then all these buildings came back to OPSB last summer. So Collegiate got the keys to the building in April of 2018. They go in, it's hot in there, it looks like some floor tiles are popping up. So when they go to take a closer look and do some testing, they figure out that there's an asbestos issue. Both districts kind of pointed fingers at each other for a while last summer, and it wasn't immediately clear who was responsible for the problem. The Department of Environmental Quality is still investigating who caused that initial issue. But it was left up essentially to the charter to discover the issue, which I think raises a lot of questions about buildings that are taken offline for a while and what exactly happens before they are given back to a school to operate in.
Sure. And, you know, asbestos was widely used until the 1980s. as a construction material. Then it was discovered that it can be harmful when it becomes airborne, causing lung diseases like cancer and mesothelioma. So most of these school buildings contain the material. But again, it's not necessarily dangerous unless it becomes airborne. So what's the end game for schools here?
I think what's really important here is that all of our schools need to have an understanding of what is in their buildings. If schools were built prior to the 80s, they are most likely going to have asbestos in them. It's normally in hidden in, I guess, what you can call safe spaces, like it's in pipe insulation. That's normally students are not exposed to. And what the state also requires is that all schools have to have an asbestos management plan. So as long as schools have that plan, see it, and are updating it every 6 months like they're supposed to, everything should be fine. But it is really important that schools know where that asbestos is in their school.
What does an asbestos management plan entail?
It includes like a floor plan of the building and any place where asbestos is located. And then what is really important is it includes places where asbestos looks like it could be becoming damaged, and that's when it could become dangerous. And parents, if they're interested, your school's website should have that asbestos plan either online or tell you where you're able to find it.
So at this point, it's out there. It's in these older buildings, and we just have to learn to be careful with it, be careful and aware of it. There's not much else that can be done.
Right. And the state's decided that that's fine as long as schools are monitoring the issue. So, yep, it's something we need to be aware of and that hopefully building managers are keeping a close eye on.
Marta Jusen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you're anything like me, when severe weather wakes you up in the middle of the night, you probably worry about what the city will look like when the sun rises. Are the pumps working? Is there flooding? Brian Knighton wakes up to those worries. He's the owner of the Broad Theater. I sat down to talk with him about how ongoing water issues have impacted his business. Brian, you opened the Broad Theater in 2016. How many times has the building taken on water since then?
I believe that this last weekend was our fifth time to take on water. And it's been a varying degrees. Like this past weekend, Mother's Day, we had about a foot and a half of water. The big one and the last one was August of 17. We had about 32 inches of water inside. And before that, it was some minor, you know, and just water sort of coming in from the street, nothing terrible.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I said take on water instead of flooding, because it all matters, right? Like,
right.
Whether it's a couple of feet or 2 inches,
right.
It's all water that needs to be dealt with.
Right, and water brings in a lot of silt and grass, and it needs to be, yeah, the building is made of mostly steel studs, but all green treated lumber. So we have a pretty quick cleanup operation now. We've gotten it down pat. So we're able to sort of spray it out and get it cleaned as quickly as possible. But yeah, it is, no matter if it's 1 inch or 10 inches, it's still cleanup.
And, you know, it seems that in New Orleans, it's smart to be able to do something like that quickly. It's smart to build so that you can clean quickly, because we know that the water's not going away. Mayor Landrieu in 2017 and Mayor Cantrell just recently both have said, you live in New Orleans, you're going to flood when there's heavy rains. How do you feel when you hear lawmakers say something like that?
I'm a firm believer of climate change. I believe that we're a city that's built below the sea level. So I somewhat agree with them. So I acquired the building in early 2015. So we opened March 2016. When I got the building, there was a gentleman working in here. He said, be careful, this building floods. And he showed me a picture, and it had probably 6 or 8 inches of water in it. But he said it only happened once in, I think, about 2 years. So I said, okay, if this happens every 2 years, I can do it. So we jump forward to our building permit as we're trying to do work, and the city's, the FEMA office, I guess, did not want to issue the building permit because they said you're below sea level. And I convinced them, and I said, look, it's my risk. So the guy gave it to me. So it's not as if the city didn't say, or it's not as if I was not aware that this building has the potential to flood. I do think that we have infrastructure problems. I think, you know, we're getting more and more rain every year. Hopefully hurricane season won't be much worse. But I do understand what they're saying. And I do believe that since Cantrell's taken office, and since the August 17 floods, they've done a lot more with sewage and water board, with drainage, with the pump stations. There's probably a lot of work that still needs to be done, but I am somewhat sympathetic to their comments about that, because I'm aware of it. It's not like it was an unforeseen risk.
I understand that your building is below sea level, as is much of New Orleans, but you look out the front door here and you can see the pump station, and
right.
the Lafitte Greenway is not far either. So
right.
you've got the pump station and you've got green space, both of which should help mitigate flooding. So why is it that your location has taken on water so many times?
From what I understand, the pump station that is towards between us and Whole Foods on the Greenway, that pump station does not service us, does not service our drain. It may now. There's been some work, and I'm not exactly sure. No one is from Sewage and Water Board or the city has come out and really explained to me, so that would be nice to show me what exactly is the arrangement with the pumps. But you can also notice that when you go down Broad and you hit that pump station, you go over a little hill, a little ramp or something. That is a major barrier from allowing water to sort of diffuse around this area and get into the Greenway. When we flooded the big time in August, just on the other side of the pumping station was dry, completely dry, whereas we had 3 feet of water. Why this water can't be pushed to the Greenway, I don't know. It seems that instead of a large infrastructure project, there could be something that's done to get water to flood that area. However, you know, the Greenway's on a ridge. I don't know, and no one has come to me and explained it to me. But from what I understand, that pumping station does not service our drains. Our drains are serviced by the one that's farther down Broad.
Yeah, and it's interesting in such a flat city in terms of elevation, those ridges, when it comes to the flow of water and who gets impacted, really do make a big difference.
Yeah. I would think that there could be an easy solution to get some of the water out of here and spread it out a little bit so it just doesn't reach our, you know, the interior. Just flood the streets a little more elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I look and you've got carpet a ways up, you know, the floor and the entry is all like stone and looks like it's not gonna soak up water. And you said you've got metal framework and stuff.
Yeah.
So how much has it cost you, though, in terms of repairs and perhaps lost business all these times you've taken on water?
I don't know recently. The most recent flood probably, you know, just a few $1,000s worth of contents and, you know, loss of revenue. But the August 17 flood was over $100,000 because we were closed for 6 days. We had some of the biggest movies of summer. We're sort of right in the middle of that. We had substantial damage to equipment because we elevated some of the equipment. We just didn't elevate it high enough, apparently. Seats we had to replace. But that one was the big hit. And then not only did we have the physical damage of the flood as it occurred, but we also have sort of the lasting impact on our customers and our reputation of folks saying, oh, when it rains, don't go to the Broad. And when it rains, you want to go see a movie. So we're sort of stuck, which I was happy. We haven't really had an incident until Mother's Day. So we went 2 years. And then we got it, along with a lot of other people. There was a lot of rain that day.
I think, like many people who live here, when I wake up in the middle of the night because of a storm or early in the morning because of a storm, basically anytime it's dark and there's a big, heavy storm, I worry. You know, I wonder what's happening throughout the city. Do you wake up, you know, panicked when you hear storms and wonder what's happening to your theater and how quickly you can possibly get here to assess the damage?
All the time. Yeah, anytime there's a rain, I think all of our staff goes into this PTSD mode. But I, certainly, you know, we're watching the radar nonstop to see what's happening. I tend to just pace and walk around either, you know, my house or here or wherever I am, just sort of waiting it out. But this last, you know, the Mother's Day rain, I live nearby, near the theater, and I really thought we were going to be okay. I said, nope, everything's fine, nothing's going to happen. And we actually did not take some precautions that we probably should have. I was sort of operating under the thought that the storm was passing north of us. But had we been a little more prepared, and we'll never make that mistake again, we could have we could have done better than we did. I mean, we lost like 3 coolers from this last flood, tons of cups and paper products and all that stuff. But next time we'll do better. But yeah, constantly worrying, constantly watching WWL radar.
What kind of precautions do you take?
We would lift everything. We would take out, because we have, you know, behind the bar, all the paper products, all the, you know, the wines, everything. We would just lift it all up because it's currently now just on the floor, basically in a cabinet. We could move some coolers up. You know, we roll a popcorn machine up to where we're sitting now in a higher elevation, roll a freezer cooler up here, that sort of stuff. Make sure our curtains are off the ground. Seats, we can take out seats relatively quickly. Those sorts of things we could have done, and we'll never not do that again.
LaToya Cantrell recently kind of won this political battle and got extra revenue from the state for infrastructure repairs. It remains to be seen what that means, you know, how that's going to help, what the plan is for that. Experts have argued that we can't pump our way out of this situation, and that, you know, pumping has in some cases led to more subsidence. Maybe we're pumping too much. So it's a very complicated problem to solve. Right. I understand you have a background in real estate. Right. Do you have any thoughts on what we should be doing, what the city should be doing to further address this problem?
The city is pretty steadfast in their BFE, you know, their base flood elevation building requirements, and that's a good thing. You have to know your location and know the way of the water and the flow of the water. Whenever we built the theater here, I built it as a proper theater where you encapsulate each auditorium to, you know, encapsulate sound from the inside and out. We had to take a lot of that out after the August 17 flood. But I think you have to build according to what you would assume would be the worst case. For example, whenever we built here, we only used moisture-resistant chipboard, like sheetrock, that has a paper coating on it. What we should have used was a paperless chipboard, which we now have in most places that are on the ground. So we had to take all that out and then replace it. Had I thought about it a little better, I would have just gone with the paperless right away. But building to the standards that the city and, you know, the federal government recommend. And sticking to that BFE, unfortunately.
And you mentioned, you know, especially with the 2017 floods, being closed for a week at a time of, you know, big summer movies, people may have gone elsewhere. But how has the community responded and supported you throughout all this?
They continue to support us, continue to come back. Whenever we post anything on social media about being closed, the response is tremendous. Everyone's like, get well soon, get back open. There's no doubt that this city needs this movie theater, loves this movie theater, and doesn't mind coming back even after we've flooded multiple times.
Brian Knighton, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. It's an important topic, and thanks for bringing the awareness.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to Behind the Lens. I'm your host, Jessica Rosegard. We'll be back next Friday, and please consider supporting nonprofit journalism in New Orleans. Go to support.thelensnola.org to make a donation today.